Luke 21:5-19. Some disciples were speaking of how the temple was adorned with precious stones and votive offerings. Jesus said, "You see all these things? The day will come when one stone won't be left on top of another. Everything will be torn down." They asked him, "When will this happen, and what will be the sign that it's about to occur?" Jesus said, "Take care. Do not be misled. Many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the one, and the time is at hand.' Don't follow them. And don't be perturbed when you hear of wars and insurrections. These things must happen first, but the end will not follow immediately." Then he said to them, "Nation will rise against nation, and empire against empire. There will be earthquakes, plagues, and famines, and in the sky there will be frightening omens and great signs. But before any of this, they'll arrest you and persecute you, bringing you before leaders and sending you to prison, bringing you to trial before rulers and governors. And it will all be because of my name and teachings. This will be your opportunity to give testimony. So make up your minds not to worry, for I shall give you the words and wisdom that none of your adversaries can contradict. You will be betrayed by your family, your parents, brothers, sisters, relatives, and even friends. Some of you may even be put to death. Everyone will hate you because of me. Yet not a hair on your head will be harmed. Stand firm, and you shall win." The word of the Lord.
So I managed, finally, to clean up around the house yesterday morning after shuffling around in the days, the dishes and the recycling and the cat hair and the dead petals from the flowers that used to be colorful were falling, and the small fragments of the last bit of crumbled hope were all piling up in dark piles of futility, vomiting darkness. How are you guys doing? I have friends that are doing pretty good at being optimistic, but I'm not really genetically predisposed for that sort of thing. I have more of a creative capacity for envisioning heartbreaking catastrophe. Maybe you've noticed. But really, it doesn't take a lot of imagination today to see white supremacy is emboldened, misogyny, homophobia, xenophobia, Islamophobia, fear, plus tyranny, plus a kind of viciousness, not in everybody, of course, but for sure this country has given a lot of power to all of this. Maybe it's okay to be optimistic, but I don't think it's okay to pretend that nothing significant has happened. And if the worst diplomatic, environmental, cultural, and economic predictions come to pass, it's not hard for me, Debbie Downer, to imagine that before long, cockroaches and coyotes and very, very rich white people in climate-controlled pods will be all that survive. The apocalyptic voice is very strong this week in my head, on my Facebook feed, and so wildly, uncannily, in the gospel passage assigned to this day in the lectionary. Some bread of life, some lilies, some babies might have been nice, but we get apocalyptic. It's like there's no getting away from it. Apocalyptic actually does well in the 21st century. Hunger Games, zombies, Black Mirror, Mad Max, all sorts of visions of dark futures. It's not surprising to me in the state we're in, but it's a little hard to believe the apocalyptic genre was so big 2,000 years ago. I mean, they never heard of cyborgs or nuclear fission or climate change. Their weapons were swords. There was no such thing as offshore drilling. There were no endangered species. What were they thinking, imagining an imminent, disastrous end? The Earth was nubile. It was hardly populated. They had no idea how much damage humans would do. Or maybe it's always been obvious. The writers of the gospel had seen the dark side of humanity. They'd experienced it. The Roman Empire was brutal. And whatever violence you could do with swords, they played that out totally. And gladiators and corrupt emperors and lions and colosseums ripping people apart, beheadings, crucifixions. The text that Alan read in Luke, it sounds like it's a prediction of things to come, but it's also really history. It was written after the Romans had crushed a Jewish uprising in Jerusalem, wiping out any resistance to their power. And it was horribly traumatic, catastrophic. Josephus, a historian writing about this time, says, "The city was filled with dead bodies still lying unburied, and those of old men mixed with infants, all dead, scattered about together, while the dread of more barbarous possibilities threatened everywhere." So I guess they might have been feeling similarly anxious. But I'm pretty sure Jesus isn't talking all apocalyptic here in order to exacerbate everyone's anxiety. From what I've read, I'd say it doesn't seem like that's usually his goal. It seems quite the opposite. Don't be anxious about tomorrow. Fear not. That was kind of a theme for him. All throughout Luke, Jesus is bringing peace. Go in peace. My peace be with you. Don't be anxious. Fear not. He says this kind of thing a lot. In this passage, he says, there will be war and insurrections and dreadful portents. You will be persecuted and hated, and some will be put to death, but don't be afraid. Seems like it might be a little hard to pull off in those circumstances. The early followers of Jesus really didn't think the world was going to last much longer. Paul says that the form of this world is passing away, that time has grown very short. Don't be anxious. I don't really always get that juxtaposition. The world's going to end. Don't be anxious. But the don't live for tomorrow thing was pretty big. The message was the kingdom of God is among you. Be very, very present and very, very awake now. As soon as you say the future, it's already past. In a way, the future doesn't exist in a very tangible way. I can't really talk about it as well as Zen masters talk about it. But the idea that life exists in the present or nowhere at all is pretty basic to any contemplative tradition. At some level, there really is no future. It doesn't exist in a very real way. There's only now, which passes pretty quickly too. By the time you say it, now, it's gone. Maybe it's important to live this way because when you are very, very present to what is in the moment, you see what might otherwise flicker by unnoticed. Maybe like a delightful taste or the warmth of the sun, or maybe your anger, would say you might notice. Your anger that turns to hatred like that. Or maybe I should just speak for myself. But that's what I've been seeing in me. I thought I was just all sad and loving and generous. But in the moment, I've been noticing some hate. Mostly turned towards powerful white men, sort of indiscriminately, so be careful. Whatever love and mercy is, it isn't something sweet and easy given by God to soothe the rich and the healthy, to soothe the perpetrators of injustice. I think maybe it's more like it dredges up what is dark and murderous below the surface in all of us. Or maybe it's just me that's murderous. But it splays it all out, and when you can't help but recognize the depth of your own darkness, you may begin to see the depth of the love of God, which does require something of you, love. I think love is painful, at least in my experience of it. It's also the most beautiful thing I've ever experienced. And I'm not crazy about the text where God seems angry, but there are enough of them in the Bible, I guess, to make one think that maybe anger has a place in love. It seems obvious with your kids if you have them, because you long for beauty and goodness. And so, like, if a bully or cancer or the freaking patriarchy threatens them, you feel anger, maybe rage. I don't know what anger means in this particular situation in the world right now, how it can be productive, but I am sure that there is a place for it. I also know that Jesus didn't lead a violent revolution. I mention it because it's crossed my mind. I know violent revolutions lead to a lot of bloodshed. I like the Christian story in part because I think it's about a God giving himself in a way God hopes will keep us from ever shedding blood for righteousness' sake ever again. I mean, it always turns out so tragically, and it doesn't usually result in much change. I don't understand it all, but I believe that God makes mercy win. The words are so constrained by the insufficiency of language. It's not win, it's not triumph, like it's some sort of sports contest. But God makes mercy like so you can dip in anywhere and find it, like it undergirds everything, though it certainly doesn't always look like it. When this Jewish minority persecuted by the Roman Empire wrote these books and said these outrageous things like perfect love casts out fear, love your enemy, and without love you have nothing, they actually have some credibility. I mean, they weren't the powerful white men just yet. They had every reason to be afraid. They were anticipating frightening violence against them. They were like the Muslims and the people of color in this country today, or the young women anticipating the coronation of groping, old, misogynist, climate change-denying men. My anger. Much more like Muslims today than they were like most of us. Mostly white, mostly safe. It was people in the midst of what seemed like total apocalypse who actually saw the difficult salvation that is love. Love your enemy. It means you have them, enemies. And means, I'm guessing, you might be on the cusp of anger turning toward hatred. The disciples weren't the Beatles in a sea of fawning fans singing, love, love, all you need is love. They had every reason to be afraid, and yet they still say, what we need is love. Maybe their witness to what love can be is reliable, not empty, not in a way of pop platitudes, not trite, not Disney princess. Cornel West says justice is what love looks like in public. I think these people, these early followers of Jesus, heard something from him that struck them to their core. They somehow recognized something in the gospel that was deeply true, undeniably, almost scientifically, physically true, and freeing. Don't live for tomorrow. It doesn't exist. Don't be afraid. Love one another right now in this moment. Be very, very present to whoever is next to you. Be very, very alive where you are, while you are. Which might not be long. But don't be afraid. God is with you, among us, like actively now, here in the present, creating, making love seems to be the best word for it, but somehow misses the oomph, I think, of how much Jesus said we can trust God. One of the Old Testament texts for tonight is an Isaiah passage, which is kind of nice to read alongside Luke's apocalyptic scenarios. In Isaiah, God says, I am creating everything anew. Be glad and rejoice forever in what I am creating. I'm creating Jerusalem as a joy and people as a delight. Like God's creating, bringing into being these joyful and delightful beings and places. As Isaiah writes of this possibility where there is no futility, where the wolf and the lamb feed together. I mean, that sounds a little bit silly, doesn't it? The wolf and the lamb feed together. But in this passage, it's like there's this very active, but maybe slow, and I don't know, maybe quiet lover that is seen to something very enormous that might really even reach the heart of the earth, to the heart of the empire now. Maybe it's a long process and there are traumas like mad, and the creating, and broken hearts and gaping wounds. It isn't an opening for the people that God's creating. Though I might take that right now if God was offering it. But clearly an opiate doesn't do anybody any good in any sustained way. You absolutely can't keep taking it without doing real damage to yourself and the people around you. Opiates make you sick. This Lord is on the throne sort of belief in a big man, God, that's going to take care of everything if you just pledge your allegiance to this man's power. I don't think that's working out very well for most of the world. I think Marx might have been right that the church has sometimes tried to manufacture the opiate. Saccharine hope, false optimism, cheap grace, salvation without suffering. But there really isn't a lot of that in our sacred text, any of them. Jesus says there will be wars and there will be tumults, there will be terrible things, but don't be afraid. Is that like a koan, like a puzzle? Or is it the reflection of some very deep truth that is beyond what we quite have access to? The God who is incarnate in the world, the God who is broken and suffers, is trying to help us know something. You don't need to be afraid. Of course, you probably are. But he sort of desperately wants us to believe him on this. About God never ceasing to bring things into being, not just things into being, but what we need and what we deeply desire. And not just what we need and desire, but something that includes everything and everyone, creating love unceasingly. Jesus says in this passage, you're going to suffer, but by your endurance you'll gain your souls. Somehow that makes me think of Gatorade commercials and pickup trucks and Marines. Like endurance means making yourself muscular. But I kind of don't think that's what Jesus meant. He is not actually a tough guy. Endurance that won't flinch in the face of suffering, I don't think that's it. He kind of flinches in the face of suffering. He cries from the cross in absolute desolation, "My God, why have you forsaken me?" He endured a lot, but not like a soldier, really, but like someone that had a heart that could break. How do you endure tumults and wars and climate change and species becoming extinct and droves and hate flowing over the banks? Maybe with a tender heart, or a heart that breaks sort of easily. That is really painful, no opiate. Like some sort of endurance that involves a tender sort of courage, love is probably a good word for it. I read in somebody's thoughts on the lectionary passage for tonight, they said, what Christians have, what Christ gives us, is indestructible hope. And I thought, that sounds good. But then I thought about plastic and preservative-laden food. And it seems like indestructible anything hardly sounds good. And maybe what we need, love and hope, each other, food, kindness, doesn't somehow exist in the realm of the indestructible, isn't in the same column or something as indestructible. Because life and vulnerability are somehow inextricable. And it is how love is possible. God is trying to make our hearts more and more breakable, though not afraid. Maybe, and believe me, I have my doubts, but maybe we or any administration aren't actually capable of exterminating God's creation or God's creativity, God's creating of love constantly. And maybe there are no other forces out there that are capable of putting an end to it either. God is so fertile or something, birthing and rebirthing and resurrecting life, and so patient, but eager to have us participate however we can. And our participation is essential. That is what love is like, of course. Our participation is essential. Organize. Resist. I'm personally not sure it's always inappropriate to break something. Make something, feed somebody, love someone, and if all you can find is something a little bit lovely in a desolate place, drink it up. It isn't an opiate. It's communion. After you participate in communion, please light a candle for mourning, for hope, or maybe for cleansing fire.